Well, this week we're going to do something more unusual than usual. Did I just say that? Anyways, it's a little more unusual than usual. I guess it's accurate. We're going to cover two Haftorah portions. This week, which is Pekudei from 1 Kings 7 and 8, and then also the Torah portion from Shemini, which comes up in 2 weeks. And there are a couple of reasons why we're doing this. First of all, it's hard to study the one Torah portion without also studying the other one right alongside of it. You just can't do it. Second of all, in 2 weeks, which is March the 15th, is the day before Purim, when we read the book of Esther. So in 2 weeks, in place of Haftorah Shemini, we're going to do a teaching on Esther. And there's some fascinating and wonderful things in the book of Esther. And it's been several years since we've done a teaching from Esther. So that's what we'll do 2 weeks from today, when normally we would be reading 2 Samuel 6 and 7. So let's turn to 1 Kings chapter 7, and we'll begin in verse 51. In the Torah portions last week and this week, the tabernacle has been described and constructed, and as we complete this week's Torah portion, Pekudei, we read the last part of the book of Exodus, and the tabernacle is finally completed. It's finally done. And so the Haftorah portions for last week and this week also cover the building of the temple, Solomon's temple. And we've been reading in 1 Kings for a week already, so we're going to continue. So we find ourselves in 1 Kings chapter 7 and verse 51. When all the work that King Solomon had done for the house of Adonai was completed, Solomon brought that which his father David had sanctified, the silver, the gold, and the articles, and placed them in the treasuries of the house of Adonai. Then Solomon gathered together the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes, the leaders of the ancestral families of the children of Israel, to King Solomon in Jerusalem, to bring up the Ark of the Covenant of Adonai from the city of David, which is Zion. Now this can sound confusing because we tend to think the city of David, Zion, is Jerusalem. And today it is. But in ancient times, if we could go in a time machine, we would see that it looks something like this. If we're standing to the south and looking north towards the city of Jerusalem, back in the days of David and Solomon, it would look more like this. You can see where the Temple Mount is back in here. That's Mount Moriah. This is the area where Abraham took his son Isaac to offer him up on the altar. But to the south of that is a very small spit of land. And this spit of land here, which is right along the Kidron Valley, and the Mount of Olives would be over to the east, this spit of land was called Zion, the city of David. So you have Jerusalem all surrounding here, and it's all part of Jerusalem, but the city of David is this area that you see here. And this is where Solomon's palace was as well. And now where the Ark had been stored, where the tabernacle had been constructed, it is somewhere in this area. We don't know exactly where. But what we're reading here in 1 Kings is that the temple of Solomon has now been completed, and they're going to bring the Ark from wherever it was. It could have been anywhere in this picture or outside of this picture. They're bringing it the short distance, the remaining distance, into the temple itself. Okay, so just to give you a little bit of a picture in your mind, I wanted to put this graphic up for you. Also, do you hear a real loud echo in here, or is that just me? Just me. Okay, I feel like I'm teaching inside of a copper pot or something. Okay, well, if it's not bothering you, it's not bothering me. Verse 2, they gathered before King Solomon every man of Israel for the festival in the month of Itanim. Itanim is another name for the month of Tishrei. And this festival, of course, would be the festival of Sukkot, or Tabernacles, which is the seventh month. And isn't it appropriate that they would inaugurate the temple during the Feast of Tabernacles? It only makes sense. All the elders of Israel came, and the Kohanim bore the ark. They brought up the ark of Adonai and the tent of meeting. So they brought up the tabernacle itself. They packed it all up, brought up all the parts of the tabernacle, and all the sacred vessels that were in that tent. The Kohanim and the Levites brought them up, King Solomon and the entire assembly of Israel that had assembled with them, were with them before the ark, offering sheep and cattle too abundant to be numbered or counted. Now, we're going to read in just a few more verses, about over in verse 9, in fact, that the ark at this time, it says, nothing was in the ark but the two stone tablets, the luchot that Moses placed there in Horeb, which is Mount Sinai, by which Adonai covenanted with the children of Israel when they left the land of Egypt. There are several things that are happening here together. When did Israel begin their journey from Egypt? What day of the year? Passover, which is the first feast, the first of the seven feasts in the spring. And now, all these years later, many years later, we have the ark making the last leg of its journey to be placed into the temple of Solomon on Sukkot, which is the very last festival of the year, the last holy day. What started at Passover hundreds of years earlier is now finally reaching the goal of the journey on Sukkot all this time later. This is why in the ark there's only the tablets of Moses. But what are the other two items that were in there before? Okay, I heard a lot of mumbling. I'm assuming it's all the right answers. Yes, it was a jar of manna and Aaron's staff that budded. They had been in there all the time it had been traveling, but now they're removed. We are given no details as exactly how or when these were taken out. But the jar of manna speaks of that journeying time through the wilderness. The journey's over. The staff, that we, as they would walk through the wilderness, the journey is over. Those two go. They're no longer needed. But what remains is the covenant, the 10 words, the 10 commandments on the two stone tablets that God gave to Moses. That stays forever. And there's an interesting thing here that we need to see. Everything about Solomon's temple is a picture of the world to come. The journey is over. Instead of being in a tent, which is a temporary dwelling, you can collapse and re-erect as you make your journeys. Now you come to the stone house that has a permanent roof. The journey is over. There's no place to go after this. It's an eternal rest at this point. And it's a picture of us. It's a picture of us. We're on a journey right now. We are in a wilderness of a world where there are all kinds of landmines you need to watch for, all kinds of things to trip you up, all kinds of temptations and tests and attacks. But there's a day coming when it's all rest and the journey is completely done. And I came across this quote by Professor Michael Fishbane. He's a professor of Jewish studies. He's been at several universities, a brilliant man. And he says, whereas the tabernacle led the people in their passages through time, because remember, the tabernacle would come into existence and go out of existence. Think about that. When they were traveling, there was no tabernacle. It was all in pieces parts, right? But when the cloud came to rest, then the tabernacle was re-erected, and now there's a tabernacle. And then later, it would be taken apart. There's no tabernacle. Now they had moved to a new place. Then it's re-erected. The tabernacle represents passages through time. It's a picture of this world. The great house in Jerusalem, Solomon's temple, now makes the people settlement in space. Now there's something very important we need to realize about this. We as human beings, we want to find God in some place. We want to go someplace to encounter him. You know, there might be a revival or something going on in some city. We want to travel and go there. Roman Catholics, they want to go to Rome, to St. Peter's, and they want to go there because they believe they're close to God there. Others will go to Jerusalem, and they want to walk where Yeshua walked and the place where the temple was because they believe that's where I can get closest to God. Some of us may think we need to go to a church building or to a synagogue. But you don't find God in a place in this world. We find God in time. If you want to encounter God, make time, and you'll find him there. And this is the theme of a wonderful book that I know many of you have read by Rabbi Heschel, Abraham Joshua Heschel, and it's called The Sabbath. And he talks about how the Sabbath is like a, not an oasis, but it's like a temple in time. And when you come to the Sabbath, this day that God has outlined and says, you keep this day holy. You don't work on this day. This is a day where you and I meet together. It's a day of gathering together with the people of God to pray, to worship, to fellowship. It's a day to rest. It's a day that is mine. I often talk with my Christian friends, and they'll ask me, well, how do you at Beth Tikkun, how do you do discipleship? And the first thing that comes to my mouth is I say we keep the Sabbath. That is absolutely the number one best way to do discipleship. Without the Sabbath, you try to get people to do quiet times through the week. When you teach the Sabbath, they got 24 hours out of the week that is set aside for God, for prayer, for study, for worship, for fellowship with his people, for study, for learning. You start with that, all the rest of the discipleship comes pretty easily. The Sabbath is a key for how we find God in time, because that is where he is found. You make time for him. And to the degree you make time for him, you're constructing for him a tabernacle in time. And you'll find him there. It's so very important we make time for him. And you know, when we honor him in this way, then he brings so much blessing to us. Now, keeping the Sabbath is not a salvation issue at all, but it is a blessing issue. Now let's go a bit further. This next passage is one that I just found incredibly fascinating. Starting with verse 6, 1 Kings 8:6, the Kohanim brought the Ark of the Covenant of Adonai to its place. Now notice the three ways this place is designated. First, to the inner sanctum of the house. Second, to the Kodesh Kodeshim, the Holy of Holies. Third, to beneath the wings of the cherubim. Now that sounds a little odd. You have to go back to chapter 6. So when you read in chapter 6, it will describe how Solomon in the Holy of Holies had two large cherubim, 10 cubits tall, which would be about 15 feet. These two huge sculptures of cherubim made out of olive wood, and that their wings would come across and go, they just span the Holy of Holies. This is an incredible thing. And then right under their wings is where the Ark of the Covenant would be placed. Of course, the Ark had a lid of solid gold with, what, two cherubim atop it. So the Ark was placed under the wings of these large sculptures of cherubim. And we go on a bit more. Verse 7, for the cherubim spread their wings over the place of the ark. The cherubim covered over the ark and its staves from above. They extended the staves so that the tips of the staves are noticeable upon the partition. That would be the parochet, the veil, from the inner sanctum, but could not be seen on the outside, and they remained there to this very day. Nothing was in the ark but the two stone tablets that Moses placed there in Horeb, by which Adonai covenanted with the children of Israel when they left the land of Egypt. And it was as the Kohanim left the sanctuary that the cloud filled the temple of Adonai, the house of Adonai. The Kohanim could not stand and minister because of the cloud, for the glory of Adonai filled the house of Adonai. And this echoes back to Exodus 40 in this week's Torah portion. Because when the tabernacle was completed, the cloud filled it, and Moses couldn't even go in because of the thickness of the cloud of God's presence. The same thing's happening here with Solomon's temple. Now let's take a look at these three designations. The first word that's used is the inner sanctum, and that word in Hebrew is the word devir. Devir. It's a very odd word. It's found a number of times as a man's name or as the name of a place. But only three places could I find where it refers to an inner sanctum. And that is in 1 Kings 8:6, which we just read. And it's used twice in this passage, one in 6 and another. It's used again in verse 8, the word devir. It's also used in 2 Chronicles 5:7, which describes the same event. the same event, Solomon's temple being completed and the ark being installed. The other place it's found is Psalm 28:2, where David says, "Hear the voice of my pleas for mercy when I cry to you for help, when I lift up my hands toward your most holy Dvar." Now, what's interesting about this word, and those of you who read Hebrew recognize that this is very similar to another Hebrew word, which is what? Dvar. Dalet, Beit, Resh. Spell the word Dvar, which means word. In fact, the book of Deuteronomy in Hebrew is Hadevarim, the words. Ela Hadevarim, these are the words. And so, Dvar is very definitely connected to the word word. In fact, in this week's Torah portion, while the men were reading, if you put the yud over at the end, it becomes divrei, which means the words of. All right? So anyone who looks at this recognizes its root as dvar, word. The second thing that's used to designate this place is the Kodesh HaKodeshim, the Holy of Holies. And then the third is under the wings of the cherubim. All of these speak of God's speech. This holy sanctum is called the Dvar, which comes from the word word. The Holy of Holies is the place where God told Moses that he would speak to him from the Holy of Holies from above the ark cover. And then this wings, the wings of the cherubim, it's only found twice in Scripture, that phrase. And the phrase in Hebrew is kanfei, a kanaf is a corner or a wing. Kanfei hacheruvim. Kanfei hacheruvim is found two places only. It's found here. It's found in Ezekiel 10:5. This is what it says. And the sound of kanfei hacheruvim, the wings of the cherubim, was heard as far as the outer court. This is Ezekiel's temple. Like what? The voice of El Shaddai. Like a voice. Everything about these three designations that Solomon puts here has to do with speech and with words. Let's bring all these threads together for a moment. With God's speech, he created the heavens and the earth. He created the entire physical universe in this world. Words. He spoke. And the words themselves became the thing. And then he brings the Israelites out of Egypt. He brings them to Mount Sinai, or is also called Mount Horeb, Charev. The word Charev, Horeb, means sword. And you know that the sword of the Spirit is the word of God, the Dvar Elohim. And from Mount Sinai, what does he give? He only gives one thing. He gives words. He speaks to all of Israel, and they were terrified. They said, "Moses, you go talk to him. We can't handle this." So Moses goes up, and God gives him words. And then on the two tablets, the two stone tablets, are recorded the 10 words. We call them the 10 commandments. In Hebrew, they're called the Esther Devarim. There's that word Dvar again, the 10 words. And then God speaks other words to Moses, which become our Torah. And basically, he's telling Moses, now you take these words and you give them to Bezalel and Aholiab. And like I spoke this world into existence, from my words, the whole world came into existence. I want you to take my words, give them to these two men, and out of those words, they'll take the raw materials of Egypt and they will create a tabernacle. They get to participate in the act of creation as much as a human being can. And then, when the tabernacle's constructed, God's presence descends in the thick cloud, and he tells Moses, he says, "Now I will speak with you from above the ark cover." Now, above the ark cover is made of one solid piece of gold with two cherubim coming out, and their wings would come up and touch right above the ark cover, so it framed a hollow space of nothing. And God says, from that hollow space of nothing, that's where I will speak from. And I will give you words. Now, for a very short time, the word became flesh and dwelt among us. But it was important that he only stay here a short time. And Yeshua, near the end, said, it's imperative for you that I go away. It's not time for you to see the word on a permanent basis. You're to be hearing it, always hearing the words. And so we see the Ark of the Covenant, from which God speaks, which contains the 10 words, put in a place called Devir, the word, and it's under the wings of the cherubim. And what does it say about them in Ezekiel, living cherubim? You could hear the sound of their wings all the way out to the courtyard, and they sounded like the voice of El Shaddai. You think something's being emphasized here? Why does God emphasize the word and hearing so much? I'm going to share with you a few paragraphs from one of my favorite authors, Rabbi Akiva Tetz. And I know many of you have read his works, and they're such a blessing. They're the kind of thing you don't read just once. Every time you read it, it's like read it for the first time because everything's so new. But he talks about why hearing is so important, why words are so important instead of seeing. And this is what he says. It says, seeing happens in the light. What is seen is clear. In Hebrew, the word for seeing, which is the word roi, is the same as proof or evidence, which is roia. It's spelled like this. Roi is just resh aleph yud. That's the word for seeing in Hebrew. All you do is you add a hey to it, and that becomes a word for proof. Proof or evidence. Isn't that interesting? Seeing and proof. Seeing is believing, right? In the Hebrew, the word for seeing is the same word as proof. What is seen is undeniable. Deeper than this, the elements of a scene are all perceived at once. When you look out, you see it all. It's right there. You might have to study details, but it's all right there. All the evidence is right there. Now, you might take time to really see it clearly, but you see it all at one time. You stand in front of the Grand Canyon, boom, you see it. There it is. It doesn't reveal itself as you stand there. It doesn't reveal itself to you a bit at a time. It's all right there for you to look at. Deeper than this, the elements of a scene are all perceived at once. Seen is an instant mode. All is seen together. Also, the scene is external. It is seen outside of the self. But the faculty of hearing is diametrically opposed to this. It happens in the dark. What is heard is not heard all at once. The elements of sound are heard in sequence over time, and they must be assembled by the listener. For example, if I say, okay, now let's take that phrase. I have it. You see what's happening? I'm taking all those little bits of sound, and it takes time to say the phrase, but you get all those bits of sound. Your brain takes each little bit, strings them together, and then translates it into your brain as a message. But it takes time to say, for example, if I say. It takes an amount of time, and you have to string it together sequentially. Correct? You follow? Hearing is internal. What is heard depends on how the listener assembles those elements. You cannot hear all the syllables of a sentence or even one word together. That would be noise. You must hear one syllable by itself meaningless, then the next and the next and the next. By the time you hear the second, the first has faded into memory. When the third is heard, the second has faded into memory. And so on. When the entire sentence is completed, the elements are combined within the listener and understood. A dark and subjective process indeed. And he says, in a world of seeing, only truth exists. But in a world of hearing, faith has a place. In the world of seeing, it's all there. Boom. One shot, kaboom. There it is. It's all there. But with hearing, there must be faith. I have to trust that I heard that first syllable correctly, and I've tucked it away, the second and the third and the fourth, and assemble them internally within myself into the message. And this takes place in the dark. This world is a dark place. But what does the word say? What does David say? Your word is a lamp, you're a lamp to my feet, a light unto my path. words provide what I can't see with my eyes. This is why when we say the Shema, Hear, O Israel, you'll see many people cover their eyes. This is an ancient tradition. It's to remind us, I can't see God. I can't even completely understand this, but I can trust it. I can believe it. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. I don't care what I see, there's one God. And the word Shema itself means not only to hear, but to gather the bits together into one unit. And the Lord, He is Echad, He is one. Let me go on and finish this quote. The sages explain that seeing is higher than hearing. The next world is seen, in this world one must hear. This is why when you read the last two chapters of Revelation, when God comes and establishes new heavens and new earth, we see Him. He's there. He's with His people. His people are with Him. And we're never separated again. And there's light everywhere. And nothing blocks anything else from view. This is why it says about the Messiah, every eye will see Him. But right now, faith comes by hearing. Spiritual light comes into the ears. Physical light through the eyes. Spiritual light comes through the ears. This is a world of process, of movement towards. I have pointed out before that the Hebrew word for the earth, the word for the world or earth is the word aretz in Hebrew. Aretz, earth. In the beginning, God created the heavens, va'aretz, va'et ha'aretz. For the earth is based on the root that means to run. The word for run is the word roots. Okay? Roots. But the name for heaven, Shemayim, is based on the word that means there, Shem, Sham. This world, Aretz, is a place where we rot roots or ratzah. It talks about Abraham running. It says he roots, he ran to prepare the food for the messengers that came. In this world, we're running. We're in the wilderness. We're moving the ark, the tabernacle. We're always moving, progressing, growing, putting things together. But heaven, Sham, is a place of rest. So we're just going, there's no place to go now because I've arrived at the only place there is, the only true place there is worth arriving to. The name for heaven is based on the word meaning there, Sham. This world is all movement towards. The higher dimension is all destination. This world moves through time since it is all process. The syllables, everything has to be assembled together into the message. The next world is beyond time because all is one there. In that world, there is truly only the moment. This idea is a key that opens some difficult areas. If one understands that what is heard in this world is seen in the world of Revelation, perplexing verses become accessible. Quote, "And all flesh shall see together that God's mouth has spoken," unquote. Surely it should state that all flesh shall hear. One does not see speech, but in that world of Revelation, one certainly does. Isn't that fascinating? You know, we always want proof. We always want evidence. And God says, here, just listen. And if you have a heart for truth, you'll recognize the truth when it's heard. And when the word speaks to you, the truth of the word, it will resonate in your spirit. And deep will call to deep. And you'll recognize. And then you'll walk by faith. You walk by what you hear. If you walk by what you see, what a train wreck that is. This is why we take the words that God has spoken. We study them. We put them in our hearts and minds. And we live our lives according to the unseen, what has been revealed to us by His words. When we do that, we make our way through this seen world pretty well. Not only do we survive it, we're blessed all the way through it. And that's an incredible thing. That's an incredible and amazing thing. You know, this word Devir, I told you that's many times used as the name of a person or a place. As I was going through, I found this verse in Judges 1:11. It says, "From there they went against the inhabitants of Devir." That's the same word. I don't know why I put a B there. It's Devir. It's the same word. The name of Devir was formerly Kiryat Sefer. You know what Kiryat Sefer means? City of the Book. How do you like that? I think God, again, is re-emphasizing something. Every place you see Devir, it's speaking of His word. It's speaking of His word. So, where does Solomon place the ark? in the Devir, in the Kodesh HaKodeshim, the Holy of Holies, under the wings of the cherubim, and their sound, you know, Ezekiel says their sound of their wings could be heard in the outer court like the voice of El Shaddai. It speaks of God's speech, of his holiness, and his power, his protection that goes out, his provision. It's a powerful passage, that little verse there in 1 Kings 8, isn't it? Well, I'm going to put this book away for a moment, and we're going to go to 2 Samuel. We're going to go to Haftorah Shemini, which is the Haftorah portion for 2 weeks from now, and I want us to jump in there. 2 Samuel chapter 6. Now, when Solomon brought the ark into the temple, did anything go wrong? Anything go wrong? Not a thing. Not only did everything go right, but God's glory showed up. The cloud came right down into the temple, just like it did with Moses' tabernacle, and filled it. And nobody could even go in because of the presence, the thickness. The arafel is the word that's used in Hebrew, which just talks about the thick darkness that is the pavement under God's feet. It talks several places in the Hebrew scriptures how the arafel is under his feet. Now, there is no darkness in God. God is light. In him, there's no darkness at all, we read over in 1 John. But though there's no darkness in him, he can hide in the dark and see like is the brightest day. The dark is to hide him from us. And maybe I should take a moment to explain why that is. God is very interested that we have free will. And there are three things that he put into the world to ensure that we would have free will. The first thing he had to do is he had to hide himself. And in Isaiah 45, the prophet says, "Thou art a God who hides himself." He hides. I mean, if I said, "Point God out to me," I don't see him. But he's here. The glory of the Lord fills the earth, but I just can't see it. Because you see, if I could see God looking down at me, I could just look up and see his eyes just looking right down at me all the time, I would never do anything wrong. Right? How many times you use something in secret that you would never do in front of somebody else? Something you know that's wrong? Because you don't want to be seen. But if you see God just staring right down through the ceiling of your house, it would be pretty good. The second thing he had to do is he had to put a space between an action and the consequence. So when you do something righteous, you don't get rewarded right away. In fact, the longer the reward is delayed, the greater it is. So people will do righteous and good and selfless things, and it looks like nothing good happens to them. Oh, but it will. It definitely will. But there's a delay. So we can be tempted not to do the right thing because nothing good happens anyway. Also, when you do something wrong, the punishment is generally delayed. Sometimes it's not, praise God. But generally, you'll do something wrong and nothing bad happens. You think, "I got away with it." You never get away with anything. There is always a day of reckoning, either in this life or in the world to come, when you have to give an account for what you did, and there is going to be a consequence. But God invented time to put a space between an action and its outcome. And we deceive ourselves into thinking that there's really no outcome to it. And so we have free will. We can choose to do what's wrong because we don't get punished right away. If you got punished immediately after every wrong thing you did, would you do anything wrong? No. The third thing he had to place was Satan. You know, when you go to vote and there's only one name on the ballot, there's no way of voting wrong. God had to give a choice B. So he created the enemy. And remember, even Satan himself is God's servant. He does only what God permits him to do or sends him to do. He's not this equal and opposite entity to God. He's not another God. He's God's sheepdog, basically. And so here's Adam and Eve in the garden. God has told them, "Don't eat of that tree." Okay. And it would never cross their minds to eat of that tree that they were commanded not to eat of. But then here comes a choice B. Well, you know what? If you eat of that tree, you'll be like him. You'll know good and evil. You're not going to die. He's not run away. And you see, so now there's an A, there's a B, an A, and a B. It's like, well, what do I do? Now there's free will. So these are the three things. There had to be, God had to hide himself. He had to put time in between an action and its consequence. And he had to create a choice B. And that's the purpose that Satan serves. With those three things, you and I have a free will. We can choose to do what's right or to do what's wrong. You take away one of those three, your free will is taken away as well. You follow? All right. I'm not even going to wait to see if somebody says no. We're just going to move on. All right. 2 Samuel 6. You should have had time to get there by now. Verse 1. Now, this story is, this is David. This is Solomon's father. And David is wanting to bring the Ark of the Covenant and the tabernacle from about 7 miles north of Jerusalem in the town of Gibeah. And he wants to bring it to Jerusalem because now Jerusalem has now become David's home. And he wants to bring the ark closer. All right? Fine. Great. Let's see what happens. David again gathered all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000. David and all the people that were with them arose and went forth from Baal Judah to bring up from there the ark of God, which is called by its name, the name of Adonai, master of legions, who is enthroned upon the cherubim as upon it. They placed the ark of God upon a new wagon and carried it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, guided the new wagon. They carried it from Abinadab's house, which was in Gibeah, with the ark of God, and Ahio walked in front of the ark. David and the entire house of Israel were celebrating before Adonai with all kinds of cypress wood instruments, with harps, lyres, drums, timbrels, and cymbals. They came to the threshing floor of Nachon, and the word Nachon means to smite, and we don't know if it was named before or after this event that's about to happen. And Uzzah reached out to the ark of God and grasped it, for the oxen had dislodged it. Adonai became angry at Uzzah, and God struck him there for the blunder. And Uzzah died there by the ark of God. Uzzah is another word for strength. Remember last week we talked about the pillar Boaz? Bo means in him, and Oz, as, means strength. This is Azah or Uzzah. It's the same root, strength. So he dies. He reaches out to study the ark. You're not supposed to touch the ark. He drops dead. God smites him dead. God became angry at him. Verse 8, David was upset. Now, what's interesting, I've got a Hebrew Bible here. It's got the Hebrew and English, and it's published by a Jewish publishing company. And one of the things is about the Jewish commentators, they hate to point out anything wrong with their Bible heroes. They'll find any way in the world to excuse the behavior of an Abraham or an Isaac or a Jacob or a David. And so in my Bible, in brackets, this is what it says. David was as upset, in brackets, with himself. He wasn't upset with himself, he's upset with God. David is upset because Adonai inflicted a breach against Uzzah. He named that place Perez Uzzah, which means the breach of Uzzah. Breach means it burst forth. God just burst forth against him, which is its name to this day. David feared Adonai on that day, and he said, how can the ark of Adonai come to me? So David refused to move the ark of Adonai to himself, to the city of David. And David diverted it to the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite. As far as we can tell, this Obed-Edom is a Gentile. The ark remained in the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite for 3 months, and Adonai blessed Obed-Edom and his entire household. So David's plan to bring the ark to himself didn't work out too well. It resulted in the death of this man named Uzzah. What is it that went wrong here? What was the error? What was it? Yes. Exactly. God commands very clearly back in the book of Numbers that when the ark travels, the priests are to carry it on their shoulders. That's what the staves were in those rings for. So you have the priest holding it on their shoulders. That's how Solomon brought it to his temple. So why did David, who loved the Torah, who knew the Torah inside out, how could he make such a glaring mistake? How could he possibly do such a thing? And the commentators, the rabbinic commentators, give two possible reasons. The first reason is that, well, the Philistines did it, and God honored them. He respected them. Because you see, you go back to 1 Samuel, you find the story of how the ark had been captured by the Philistines. This is when Eli was the high priest. And they took it and put it in the temple of their god, Dagon. And every time they got up in the morning, the idol was on its face. And finally, one morning, its head and its arms are broken off. They figured, we got to get rid of this ark. What do we do? So one of the wise men said, make a new cart and have a milk cow pull the cart, put the ark on there, and just let him go. And so they did. And these milk cow, I think there's two milk cows, weren't there? One or two? But they just took off in a beeline straight back to Jerusalem, straight back to Israel. And they came to the field of Beth Shemesh, which means house of the sun, S-O-N, S-U-N. Shemesh is sun, house of the sun. And it's a wonderful story. So David might have thought, well, you know what? The Philistines made a cart, and God honored them for that. Well, I'll make a cart. But you see, the commentators say, but the Philistines did it in ignorance. They wanted to honor God, and God honored their decision because that was the best information they had. That's the best thing you could do to figure it out. But for those who know the word, God expects better. And I think we can be careless, and we can look at things in the world that seem to work and think, well, let's employ that strategy in our congregation, in our community. Let's start doing things the way they do out there and bring it in here. God honors it out there. At least they're getting a lot of money for what they're doing, so let's bring it in here. But we don't bring the practices of the Philistines into the house and the community of God. I don't care how great of an idea it is. And a cart's a great idea. It's not as labor-intensive as carrying it. But it cost a man his life. It was a mistake. It was a mistake. We need to be very careful that we don't look to the world for ideas on how to be a successful community. We look to the Torah. We look to the words of the Master, Yeshua. We look to the Word of God, and it tells us everything we need to equip us for every good work. You know, Yeshua, he tells his disciples, I'll make you fishers of men. And how did they fish? They used a net, right? You throw the net into the water, and later you pull it up, you see what you got. But too often in the modern Redeemed community, I don't see nets being used. I see spear guns. I see baited fish hooks. I see all kinds of things being used that are not a net. And then we wonder what's wrong with the people who are coming in that we're catching. We're not to bait hooks. We're not to hunt down individuals. I'm going to get his soul. I'm going to get him for the Lord. You know, we don't do that. You throw your net out into the dark of the depths. And then you take what comes into it and bring it into the light. This is the method God has designed for us to win souls. We throw out the net of our lives. It's like my friend Angus, who is here, a rabbi from Trinidad. And he said, we read the Torah, and then the world reads us. And your life becomes something where some people are going to get stuck in it and say, what's the hope you have? What is this hope? What's this joy you have? I want to know how you live your life. I don't see anything like it. And so they come into our net. They swim in. We didn't go after them. They came in. We begin to grow them up. We bring them into the light. And other people will come in our lives and they'll swim back out. And then later swim in and back out. And later they'll swim in and they'll stay. But we're to live a life. That's what we do. We live a life. I don't see Yeshua, except on one occasion, going after an individual. That's the woman at the well. On all the other occasions, he's doing what he does. He's living a life. He's teaching those who happen to come nearby. One rich young ruler, he let go away sorrowful. He let him go. He swam back out of the net. Maybe later he came back and joined with Yeshua and his followers. But Yeshua, he lived a life. He lived a life and changed the world. So let's live a life. But we need to move on because the time is running out. There's another bad thing that happened. We go a bit further and we pick it up in verse 12. King David was told, Adonai has blessed the house of Obed-Edom and everything he has because of the ark of God. David then went and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with joy. Whenever the bearers of the ark of Adonai walked six paces, he slaughtered an ox and a fatling. David danced with all his strength before Adonai. David was girded in a linen ephod. I don't know why, because an ephod was something that the priest wore. David was not a priest. David and the entire house of Israel brought up the ark of Adonai with loud, joyous sound and the sound of the shofar. And it happened as the ark of Adonai arrived at the city of David that Michal, daughter of Saul, who was David's wife, Michal, not Saul, his wife, peered out the window and saw King David leaping and dancing before Adonai, and she became contemptuous of him in her heart. They brought the ark of Adonai and set it up at its place within the tent that David had pitched for it. And David brought up elevation offerings before Adonai and peace offerings. When David had finished bringing up the elevation offering and the peace offerings, he blessed the people with the name of Adonai, Master of Legions. He distributed to all the people, to the entire multitude of Israel, man and woman alike, to each person one loaf of bread, one generous portion of beef, and one container of wine. Then all the people left, everyone to his home. David returned to bless his household. Michal, daughter of Saul, went out to meet David and said, "How honored was the king of Israel today, who was exposed today in the presence of his servants' maidservants, as one of the boars would be exposed." The word there for boars is the word rakim. Remember how Yeshua in the Sermon on the Mount talks about, call your brother raka, okay? It means a worthless person. David answered Michal, "In the presence of Adonai, who chose me over your father, and over the entire house, to anoint me as ruler over the people of Adonai. Over Israel, before Adonai, I will rejoice, and I will behave even more humbly than this, and I will be lowly in my eyes, and among the maidservants of whom you spoke. Among them I will be honored." Michal, daughter of Saul, had no child until the day of her death, so he broke off relations with her. So we have another negative event. And how are we to assess these? How are we to analyze these? I think David, who is a man after God's own heart, has wonderful intentions. He's a good man. God blessed him. And God has done incredible things in his life and will continue to do incredible things in his life. But I think these two events here are showing us that as close as we may be to God, as full as our heart may be to serve him and to promote his kingdom in this world, we need to be careful of two things. And I think the story of Uzzah teaches us one of those things, and the story of Michal teaches us the other. The story of Uzzah teaches us, don't copy the ways of the world, as effective as they may look, and don't be presumptuous. There's a very clear commandment in the Torah, you do not touch the ark of the Lord. You don't do it. And Uzzah did. And I think we, as we draw close to God, as we develop intimacy with him, as we develop confidence in our walk, and we should, and as we get to know him better in his word, there's always that chance we become a little too presumptuous, a little too familiar. And our love for God increases, but our fear of him begins to diminish. We are to fear him and to love him. And if you just love the Lord, you don't fear him. You're going to be way too casual with him. If you fear him, you don't have love, you're going to be very legalistic and cold. But when you put the two together, like fire and water, which can't exist in the world, but wherever you find God's presence, you find water and fire dwelling in peace together. In fact, the word shalom, peace, the first letter is shin, the letter of fire. And the last letter is mem, mayim, which means water. And when we know God, these two opposites dwell together. So fear of God and love of God is something we are capable of, but we must learn to keep them together in balance. The other thing is David was one to sing and to rejoice. And you know, the Bible tells us, be angry, but don't sin. Be angry, but sin not. Why does he give this warning about anger? It's because when you're angry, you come right up to the brink of losing control and going off the edge into sin. So stay away from anger, and you're going to be staying away from sin. But I think that same principle can be applied to our rejoicing. You know, I'm not an angry person. I mean, I've been angry before, and it's not pretty, but generally I don't get angry very easy. So I thought, okay, I'm pretty well off of that. Be angry and sin not, I just won't even be angry, and I don't get angry easy. On the other end, I get really silly and giggly and laugh, and start making fun and making jokes and making people laugh and being humorous. And so many times, my rejoicing, my happiness, my joy will bring up the edge and I step over. And I think the principle of anger can be applied also to rejoicing. David's rejoicing as he should, making music as he should. He should dance. He should do all these things. But he went over a line. And there are some secrets, there are some things hidden in the Hebrew that teach us this. It says here that the word that is used for his rejoicing is a word that means to be frivolous. It's the same word that's used in Judges when the people said, oh, let's bring Samson and will make sport of him. It's that word. It's not a word that should be used when it comes to truly rejoicing before the Lord. This is what it says. The word usually used for rejoicing is semechim, from the word semach, which means just to rejoice. Our verse uses a word that implies a more frivolous, lighthearted type of mirth. And this usage, a Barbanel, which is, he was a rabbi, lived in the 15th century, sees another allusion as to why this event ended in tragedy. Instead of rejoicing before the Lord in a positive and reverent manner, the people engaged in inappropriate merrymaking. Learning from his father's error, when Solomon brought the ark to the newly built temple, he invited only the elders and leaders to be part of the procession. Another commentator analyzes the instruments that were used to play. He says these are not the right instruments. When you read deeply into the word, you find that in the temple, it was the Levitical choir that sang and their particular instruments that were used. Here you just got this free-for-all, and you've got instruments that generally were not used inside the temple and for holy purposes. It's like it's a little too casual. A little too careless. And when David was dancing to a degree where he was actually exposing himself, and there's a commandment against that, it's like the pleasure he brought God's heart from the rejoicing was contradicted by the embarrassment and the brokenness that came because of it and the way it was done. We see Solomon doing it exactly right. We see the son of David doing it exactly right. And remember, I don't want to sit here and say David was in great sin. I think the word is giving us here, the Lord is telling us in this chapter, be careful. Don't be presumptuous. And don't go over the edge with the joy you get from worshiping God. There should be joy in worshiping him. But you know, you can go to the place where it's not spiritual, it becomes just a fleshly exercise. I think we've seen that in our experiences. We need to be extremely cautious. Let's do it within the right parameters of decency, of joy, and of honor to God. Yes, Adam, I see your hand up. Oh, you weren't raising your hand?
No, I was raising my hand. I wasn't raising
it. Oh, okay.
World War II. And I know when I read the comic book first previously, I always thought it was specifically to illustrate a person and saying, like, whoa, when you're saying to a guy, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
And she's saying, no, so I was assuming that she was in the wrong here. But, I mean, is there, so there is merit to what she's saying.
I'm glad you asked the question, because that's exactly what we're going to look at here next. I put together this little thing here to help sum up what we've read in these two accounts. I call it the Ark's broken journey. We have the first leg that ended in Uzzah's death, and the second leg that ended in a broken marriage. Now, in both cases, David's in error. It's not great sin. He's not rebellion. He's not doing some great pesha, some rebellious sin. He just didn't adjust things quite right. He didn't have the dial tuned just right. So he errs. He has a new cart made instead of having the priest carry it exactly the way God said to. Here he errs by going over the edge a bit too much in his exuberance and in his carelessness, and his joy turned into a bit of a fleshly display. But also, Uzzah errs. If David hadn't have goofed, Uzzah wouldn't have goofed. And over here, Michal errs. But if David hadn't goofed, Michal wouldn't have goofed. There's an important principle here. When you are in a place of authority and responsibility, your errors can lead to the errors of those who are looking to you for their cues. This is why I'm always impressing upon our elders and to myself, because I'm just one of the elders here, reminding the men when we get together, we are the example setters. Don't ever forget that. We are the example setters. And according to 1 Timothy, our reward will be great in the kingdom if we do our job well. But the consequences of doing it poorly will be great. Okay? Everything's magnified when you're a place of authority. So we need to be very careful what we do, because David's errors led to two other errors. In Uzzah's case, it led to death, but in Michal's place, it led to a broken marriage. In the first case, David becomes angry with God for killing Uzzah. In the second, he becomes angry with Michal for pointing out David's error. In Michal's case, she's denied children. In David's case, he's denied the temple. Because in the very next chapter, in 2 Samuel chapter 7, David requests that God permit him to build the temple, and God says no. Now, there's some different reasons. The blood on his hands, 2 Chronicles tells us about. Others tell us because God knew that there would be the sin with Bathsheba, and that God knew that was something that's going to happen and prevent it. There are a lot of different reasons. But I think the timing here, the placement of these stories is very, very instructive. I want to share this with you. It has to do with Michal and David's relationship. Many of you have read the book, The Garden of Peace, by Rabbi Shlomo Arush. If you're a man, a married man, you need to read this book. It will revolutionize your marriage. It's an incredible book, but it's only for the men. Women, you're not allowed to read it. It's just for men. But one of the things he emphasizes is this. The wife is a mirror of the husband. Any deficiency he sees in her is actually his own deficiency. That's like standing before a mirror, and what you see in the mirror is ugly, and so you start, you know, say, I get a new mirror. I need to fix this mirror. This looks awful. You know, what you have to do is change you, and then the image changes. This is one of the things that God has created and wired into the woman. She doesn't even know she's doing it. But the woman was made out of man. Man was made out of the dirt. Woman's made out of the man. She's made from the man for the man, and she reflects him in a very particular way. She doesn't even know she's doing it. She just does it. And this is why I always say that if I'm going to know how a man's relationship with God is, all I've got to do is look at his wife, look in her eyes. Because that tells me everything I need to know about what his relationship with God is like. Because the woman will reflect to the man, a mirror to him, what the man's relationship with God is. And if his relationship with God is wonderful, her relationship with him will be wonderful. A 16th century rabbi, Rabbi Avraham Azulai, says, the way a person acts with God is exactly the way his wife will act with him. Men, you don't like the way your wife is acting, the way she's responding to you. Then you need to check how you're responding to God. You don't think she's giving you respect? Well, how are you respecting God? You don't think she's giving you the time that you deserve? Are you giving God the time he has commanded? Is she giving you the silent treatment? Well, what's your prayer life like? If she doesn't seem to be very happy at home with you, what's your gratitude been like towards God? I could go on and on and on. I tell you, if you want to have a wonderful marriage, guys, then have a deep and abiding and secure relationship with God. A relationship, because you're his bride, right? You need to be thoughtful and thankful and rejoicing, looking to his needs, looking to his commandments, what pleases him. I guarantee your marriage will be absolutely wonderful. It'll be incredible. And so I think what Michal is doing here, as she corrects David, she's pointing out a flaw between David and God. And when David tells her, no more children, God's telling David, no temple. No lasting temple for you. And there are other connections here I'll leave you to find. I was watching the clock, but I see Jim saying it. Jim, I'll give you the last word this morning.
Am I thinking correctly in that when God spoke, he spoke to Moses, and Moses gave it to the Israelites, then Yeshua comes, and when he speaks, everybody in the area hears.
Yeah.
Is there significance to that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a little off topic from what we're talking here, but absolutely, yes, yes. And he took the words of Moses and explained them because they had gotten into the letter and to the legalism, and Yeshua came and restored the spirit to what the Torah was really saying. Yeah, so he came to that's what the whole Sermon on the Mount about is Yeshua explaining the heart of Torah to people.
Is there reason then that
I tell you what, that's a good question, but I'm going to say that for another time because there's just not time to answer that, but that will come up again, I promise. Okay, so hold that question, hold that thought, all right? I wished we had time to go back to 1 Kings, read the rest of chapter 8, and then Solomon's prayer, which goes on for dozens of verses. So that's something for you to do this afternoon. Go back to 1 Kings and read the rest and read Solomon's prayer. Solomon's a son of David. Solomon's a picture of Yeshua in so many ways. And when you read Solomon's prayer, it's almost like you're getting a glimpse into Yeshua's heart. And so I wish we had time. There's just no way we're going to get to that this morning. So how many promises are going to read, go back to 1 Kings and finish that whole chapter and read Solomon's prayer? Oh, good, three of you. No, there are the hands, okay. And I promise you'll be blessed. It'll just put the icing on the cake. It's a wonderful passage, and I am going to go and read it again this afternoon. It's just a blessing to read. So let's close in prayer. Father, thank you so much for all your blessings to us. And Lord, I pray that we would always be attentive to what pleases you. And call us your bride. And I pray, Father, that we as men, who sometimes find that term uncomfortable, will realize that it's something very spiritual. And we would find ourselves responding to you with love and with gratitude, with respect. We would take your desires seriously, and we would be found faithful always to you. Lord, if we do that, what wonderful marriages we will have as our wives reflect back to us our affection and love to you. Lord, I pray you would make the marriages here strong, and I thank you that they are. Make them stronger. Make them exemplary in this world. And Lord, I pray that in our rejoicing, and Lord, this is a happy community, but I pray, starting with me, you'd help me not to be silly, not to take away from the honor that's due you, by acting like a jester. To not use sarcasm as a means of showing affection. But Lord, to use humor in a holy way, and in a profitable way, in a wise way. And that in all, everything I do as I express joy, I pray that I and all of us together would do so in a way that brings honor to you and not embarrassment to you and to the community. Make us the people you want us to be. Don't let us be presumptuous and reach out and touch holy things that we're to keep our hands off. Let us learn to fear you as well as love you. Because we know that the fear of the Lord makes us clean. So Lord, help us to be the healthy people without spot and wrinkle that you want us to be. We'll give you the praise for it. For Lord, without you, without your words, we would be blind and lost. We thank you for providing us the light of your word. Help us be faithful to walk in it always. And this we will do with the help of your Spirit, with the help of Yeshua, in whose name we pray. Amen. Well, Tim...